Rewind, your week in review is sponsored by the Wisconsin Realtors Association, bringing Wisconsin communities to life with great homes, businesses, and neighborhoods. The Wisconsin Realtors Association, the voice of real estate.
This program is brought to you from Wisconsin Eye's Margaret Farrow Studio.
This week on Rewind, your week in review, Governor Tony Evers makes a significant veto, an attempt to secure school funding increases for the next 400 plus years. Coming up, we break down his partial vetoes and what possible legal challenges may arise. Plus, tax cuts or tax increases, the two stories Democrats and Republicans are painting about using a portion of the state's surplus to return to taxpayers. And the fate of the state's top election official is still in limbo. All this and more on Rewind, your week in review for July 7th.
Hi, I'm Emily Fannin.
And I'm J.R. Ross.
J.R., let's break down the state budget highlights now that Governor Evers did sign it, but before he signed it, he issued 51 partial vetoes. Now, a lot of these vetoes, I would say about two of them specifically, are making big headlines, but let's first just take a bigger picture of what he did. So first, Evers raised revenue limits for public schools by $325 per student for the next 402 years, or until 2425. Yes, you heard that correctly. That is for the next four centuries. He also cut income taxes by $175 million over the next 2 years, which is a fraction of what GOP lawmakers propose. He also was able to use his broad veto authority to retain 188 employees at UW campuses that work on diversity, equity, and inclusion efforts. However, there is still included in that state budget that $32 million cut at the UW system for diversity programs, etc. Now I just want to go on to other highlights. So let's just bring up this other slide before we dive into many of these issues. In addition to those vetoes, he also wiped out $1 million earmarked for the restoration of a dam in Burlington, which is Assembly Speaker Robbins Voss district. That might have been purposeful. Also reworked a $10 million grant to visit Milwaukee ahead of the city hosting the Republican National Convention in 2024. So that impact basically leaves a $1 million grant to visit Milwaukee with the other $9 million going to the state tourism department for general marketing purposes. Now, the Gov also removed a requirement that the state would award that grant in the fiscal year of 2023-2024. Here's what remained in the budget. Like I mentioned, that $32 million cut for UW system, $125 million to combat PFAS, $1 billion for public schools, more money for voucher schools, pay raises for state employees, correctional officers, assistant district attorneys. I wanted to highlight those because that was the governor's reasoning at his press conference for why he didn't veto the entire budget. We did hear that he potentially basically threatened to do so with those UW cuts. But he said, I couldn't do that because then I would be abandoning a lot of my other priorities, like the ones I listed off, you know, PFAS contaminants, investments in schools, etc. Let's first hear from the governor, and then we'll dive in more into his partial vetoes.
In many ways, Republicans in the legislature have failed to meet this historic moment. In light of these short-sighted decisions, there are those who would have me veto the entire budget. Vetoing this entire budget would mean abandoning priorities and ideas that I've spent 4 years advocating for, as I'm glad that the legislature joined me in making critical investments in several key areas. The fact remains that this budget remains imperfect and incomplete.
Let's first start with tax cuts. So what Evers did is that he knocked out the two top income brackets that Republicans wanted to condense from four to three brackets. And that change basically from an average from the Republicans' plan, now this is numbers from the Legislative Fiscal Bureau, they averaged an average tax cut under the GOP plan would be $573. With Evers' changes, now the average is roughly around $36. Now, of course, that depends on how much you make. It trickles down on a chart. But this has been a huge kind of, I guess, different storytelling that we're hearing from. Evers said, I did this so the millionaires and billionaires wouldn't get these huge, massive tax increases. What, meanwhile, Republicans are pretty furious over this move because they say now people aren't really getting much of the $7 billion surplus, which they believe should be rightfully, at least a portion, be returned to taxpayers.
So looking at that LFB memo, I'm not a big fan of the average number when it comes to tax cut, because if you get a $1 million tax cut and I get a dollar tax cut, is the average really $500,000?
Right.
So, but looking at that memo, there's a big shift from the bulk of the benefit on the GOP plan went to those making above $100,000. That ends under what Evers did. Basically, most of it goes away. I mean, you're talking like $3 a month for most people, what they might see in their checks. The reality is Republicans knew he was going to veto the top income tax break. They knew going into that. It was actually almost like a sacrificial lamb. Because the governor had said way back when he would not sign a budget with a reduction of that rate of 7.65%. They were surprised somewhat by the other veto, which is basically kind of a big chunk. The top one's about $750 million of $3.5 billion. There's $175 left. The rest is that money in between income about $36,000 and $405 for married joint filers. They thought he would sign that would be something he could find palatable. Now, the question I have going forward is what's going to happen with that money, because it doesn't go away. What the governor vetoed now goes back to the general fund, or remains in the general fund. Doing some back-of-the-napkin math, we are going to have $3.5 billion for a surplus to start the 25-27 budget, barring a recession or a new deal. Now, tensions are kind of high right now between Robin Voss and the governor's office, but you could see this fall maybe come back trying to pass on a tax cut. Maybe there's a deal to be struck of, okay, governor, let's do this tax cut, but pair it with something you want to get a deal done. But if they don't do that, we're going to have the same conversation in 2 years of tax cuts versus school aids, because we're going to have a lot of money we're sitting on, and that's the reality. It could be as much as $4 billion after this budget is done.
Right, and Voss also said he wants to restore those tax cuts. That means possibly coming back into session, but as you and I both know, the Assembly doesn't have the numbers for a veto override, whereas the Senate does, but he's still tossing the idea out there of what they might do. Also, Evers already said he would promise to veto probably likely whatever that plan looked like if it was the same exact one. Now let's get to the one that made almost national headlines, which was his veto related to school funding increases. Now let's just bring up the slide of the exactly how he crafted this, which was unique, but these are powers that Republican and Democratic governors for many, many years have had. He crossed out, as you can see in red, the 2024 school year and the hyphen to basically change the next school year to go as long as 24-25. So this is kind of what really, I would say, outraged a lot of Republicans, conservatives. Meanwhile, there was more other reaction, too, of, well, everyone's kind of had these powers over the years. Why can't the governor do this, too? So it's kind of a point of political tension right now, Chair.
So let's unravel the onion. First off, yes, the governor's changed state law to put in there this increase every year of $325 for four centuries. The reality is, however, it's not going to last for four centuries. Anytime you change law, you can change law again. Actually, the governor could come in tomorrow with Republican lawmakers and reach a deal to change that number in out years. Now, as part of their agreement, they were already going to increase the spending cap by that much in the first two years of this budget. This veto really impacts the out years beyond this budget. So there's number one. It's not locked in for 400 years. Number two, does not guarantee property tax increases. Remember, this is a cap on how much schools can spend between state aid and property taxes for the biggest pot of money. There's other funding over here, but this biggest pot of money. If the state funds all that increase in out years, there will be a minimum increase impact on school property tax levies. Now, each district, it can be different. If you're a wealthy district, you're going to hit harder with this than a poorer one. So there's no guarantee of property tax increases, but it is going to require, just back in the napkin math again, out years, about $260 million more each year in funding between state aid and property taxes. So go 25-27, $260 million the first year, keep that the second year, that's 520 plus 260, that's 780, rough back in the math, to put into schools to keep things going, all right? There's that. Now there's a question of, did Evers break a deal, right? Robin Voss now calling the governor a liar. That's his word, a liar, that he lied to Republicans during negotiations. My question is, what was the lie governor told? Did he tell them, I won't veto anything going forward? Did he tell them this is the deal? I don't know, because I haven't had a chance to ask Robin yet. What's been interesting, though, is that Robin Voss is accused of governor lying, but Devin Lemmy, who has not used that word in his reaction to what the governor did, he has complained about reducing the tax cut. There are probably the three people, and who really happened are Tony Evers, Robin Voss, and Devin Lemieux, plus their top aides. So there are three parties in that room, and one is saying something nobody else is backing up yet. Mm-hmm. I kind of want to know what actually happened. And then two, what this means going forward. There wasn't really a big kumbaya moment in this budget where you really had truly Robin Voss and Tony Evers holding hands and saying, we're back on the same page.
Are they ever? Know?
Yes. If you recall, when the shared revenue deal was kind of agreed to, I asked Robin Voss, you've called the governor feckless. Right. You've said he's basically incompetent. Is this a new day in the Capitol? Robin didn't compliment the governor. He complimented the county executive of Milwaukee and the mayor, saying that, you know, they were the heavy lifters in this deal. So there was not really a big spread of compromise after this anyway. So, but things are frazzled. Happens a lot in the Capitol.
It's just another day.
But what happens now is we have basically a two-month break. July and August are basically off. Tensions will cool. So come September, might we see some kind of a, okay, let's try this over again kind of thing? Or is it going to be more, hey, we're going to try to override your veto. We're going to have this. We're going to go try and put your vulnerable members in the assembly and swing districts in uncomfortable positions on a middle-class tax cut and go from there.
Right. And also, we wanted to just explain to just how powerful these veto powers are, because since 1990, they've changed kind of dramatically. And I should say just over the past several decades, they've changed. Before 1990, governors could veto individual words to create new words. That was known as the Vanna White veto. And then up until 2008, there was also in place what's called the Frankenstein veto that would eliminate words and numbers in two or more sentences to create a new sentence. Now, none of those are in place anymore, but the last time Evers vetoed a budget in 2019, his veto powers were also challenged. And that's why this debate comes up again, because when the state Supreme Court heard that lawsuit, the justices couldn't reach a majority opinion. So that really just leaves out this unknown for this unset of rules of what can be done for future vetoes. That was a lawsuit filed by the Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty. I spoke to the president, Rick Essenberg, yesterday, saying, hey, you're going to file a lawsuit because you've been in this arena before. You've brought forth this argument. Is it going to be you? Now, he was kind of joking with me. Good try. I'm not going to tell you, but I would like to see a lawsuit come forth. So let's just hear from him before we dive into what could come next.
I would not be surprised if somebody were to challenge this, because it certainly is inconsistent with the spirit of the Bartlett decision. And it's not the way that anybody would design a system of lawmaking. And while I appreciate that both Democrats and Republicans have done it in the past, it's time to stop. This is not the way that laws should be made in this country, and certainly not the way that we should decide to spend billions and billions of dollars.
So at this point, I see it as three options. You can go to court. You could figure it out through the legislature or through the next budget, which is probably unlikely because Governor Evers is still going to be governor. Or I've heard some tell me there's a possibility of another constitutional amendment. Mm-hmm. We've seen them introduced before. They can change the Constitution. They can bypass the governor because he can't veto constitutional amendments. But that also takes some time. It has to pass two consecutive sessions. So most likely, I think it's going to be a lawsuit. We even heard from Speaker Voss basically calling on Republicans, conservatives, his base, to say, someone do something about this.
Yeah. So first off, well, the government is not unprecedented. Scott Walker in the 2017 budget struck out individual numbers to create a 1,000-year veto. There is this old program for those revenue limits, again, for schools, in which you could exceed your revenue limit if you're doing basically an energy efficiency project. All right. The legislature wanted a one-year moratorium. Walker struck out a couple of numbers, made it a 1,000-year, 1,001-year actually moratorium. Same budget, he also turned a one-year delay into a 61-year delay, again, striking out some numbers. Now, the Supreme Court in 2020 had two different decisions on the same day. One you talked about. There was not a consensus of these Evers vetoes. There were a consensus to overturn three of them, but not the reasoning why. So it's not a clear standard to use going forward. The second case was about the Walker vetoes. They happened in 2017, lawsuit filed October 2019. The court said you waited too long to challenge them. The budget was basically done by October 2019. You can't wait that long to file a lawsuit. They didn't say what the window is to file a lawsuit, but basically once a budget's in the books, that's too late. We don't know the merits of that case. We do know, though, Rebecca Bradley, a conservative, wrote that she thought that the veto overstepped Governor Walker's authority, She is a big proponent of the legislative branch. She thinks there's been too much ceded to the executive branch in her writings. So you could count on her to overturn Evers' veto on the 400-year veto. Problem is, she's only joined by Daniel Kelly in that decision, that dissent. He's only on the court. We're going to go from a 5-2 conservative majority that was in place for those decisions in 2020 to a 4-3 liberal one in August. So we don't have a good roadmap of what might happen with a lawsuit if and when one is filed. Now, Robin Voss has suggested that it's not his first choice for the legislature to file a lawsuit. Maybe they will. I think he's hoping for somebody else to do it for them. But it'll be a fascinating legal ballot. And then it'll be kind of a first real test of this new liberal majority, where are they at on executive branch powers versus legislative branch.
Right, and because once comes August 1st, incoming Justice Janet Protasiewicz would be sworn to the bench, like you mentioned, and it's just going to be interesting to see what that court comes with, because they're going to have a lot to deal with, especially too also with the abortion ban that's going to be likely brought through that court once it gets figured out in lower courts. All right, let's move on from the budget, because there are other things to talk about, and one of these headlines is basically from last week, which is still unknown of the fate of Megan Wolf, who is the state's chief election officer. It was last week the Senate brought forth a resolution on the floor to basically move forth through her confirmation process. Democrats and Democrats on the Wisconsin Elections Commission disagree. They think it's unlawful that they're moving through this because there wasn't, they believe, a unanimous vote the day prior to advance her. So she is still in this almost holding period based off a former state Supreme Court ruling that says as long as there's not a vacancy or, forgetting the other scenario on top of my head, as long as there's not a vacancy or a replacement, a replacement, she can stay in the post. So now the big question is when is going the Senate committee going to take this up? And I think the question is, too, is Megan Wolf even going to show when they put it on the calendar?
So the Senate leadership referred the nomination, the disputed renomination of Megan Wolf, to committee late Monday, right for the holiday. It is now before the Shared Revenue Elections Committee, which is chaired by Dan Knodel, won a special election in the spring to take that seat. They don't have anything scheduled anytime soon. In fact, if you look at the website listed right now, there's no committee hearing
meetings,
in the month of July.
The entire month, yeah.
So the issue is going to be, when can you get the committee together to meet? Because, you know, lawmakers take vacation. They go do stuff in the summer after the budget is done. They know it's going to be done about June 30th, and they take off after that. So getting that body together is the first thing. Number two, the Senate's not back on the floor until at least September 12th. That's the first time they have a floor period in the fall. So barring a special session to take this up, you're talking about a vote possibly 14 months out from the 2024 election. The math to get Megan to 17 votes to send is pretty tough. You start with the 12 Democrats, but Lena Taylor has said she opposes her renomination because Lena believes that decisions made in 2020 impacted her loss by a significant margin to Tom Barrett in the mayoral race. I don't know that Megan Wolf is the one who drove those decisions, but that's besides the point. She has a beef with the Elections Commission, and that's her position. She's 11 Democrats. You need 6 Republicans to vote to get 17. Where do they come from? Two, those Republicans have a base that is, for a lot of them, convinced the election was stolen from Trump in 2020. Megan Wolf has become the target of those kind of complaints, fair or not. So it's kind of hard to get that math at 17 votes. Okay, so they have a vote. What happens? One, Ann Jacobs, the Democratic former chair of the Elections Commission, said she might file a lawsuit over this whole thing. Could Megan file a lawsuit? Could the Elections Commission file a lawsuit? I mean, like this.
Lawsuit City is what I call it.
Spent a lot of time in court for being political reporters.
Yes.
So there is a very convoluted timeline, and my impression is with the Senate, they're doing this process in part, they want to have their pound of flesh. Like these Republicans have their bases, weren't happy about stuff. This is a way to get their complaints out in the open and have their say about this. I have no idea what's going to happen beyond that going forward.
Right. I have heard possibly next week through some people that I've talked to. I've not got that confirmed from Knodel's office. I know you haven't heard much from them either, but that's our job to bug them to hopefully see when that will be placed on the calendar. I do just want to bring up again, I think it's going to be a tough position. I mean, does she go? Does she show up?
Yeah.
If she doesn't show up, does it just turn into, you know, a place for Republicans to just kind of spat their beef with Megan? Because we've heard many of their complaints before, which are basically the fallout of the presidential election back in 2020. It was based on policies that the commissioners enacted, not Megan Wolf. So that's kind of always been the misinterpretation of how the system works. There was policies, you know, such as sending absentee ballot applications to all voters, ballot drop boxes. There was a lawsuit over that. So those are kind of the main, I guess, why many Republicans are grumpy about this. But there is out there kind of this misconception that all the blame should be on Megan Wolf when she doesn't really have a vote and a lot of say in a lot of these decisions.
She did, for example, with like the money from Mark Zuckerberg that went to the CTCL.
I was just going to bring that
up. She did like email, okay, here are best practices, right? That wasn't really authorized by the commissioners. So there's that. But otherwise, yeah, she's not the one who's driven these decisions to not send special voting deputies to nursing homes to conduct absentee balloting during the pandemic. The other thing for her to consider is if she shows up, does she legitimize the nomination process, the renomination process, I should say, in the eyes of the court, right? Mm-hmm. So if you participate, are you acknowledging that, this actually is proper what they did? Again, that's going to be a court's going to decide that at some point.
Right, and that's why I think she might not show. Yeah. But it remains to be seen. We'll see what happens. There could be even a lawsuit before that.
Yeah.
All right, looking ahead to 2024, we got some new fundraising numbers from U.S. Senator Tammy Baldwin that we're going to talk about. Over the past 3 months, she raised $3.2 million, which her campaign says is the most ever raised by Wisconsin Senate candidate for a quarter in a non-election year. So she raised $2.5 million in the second quarter of 2017 on her way to raising $30.9 million for her successful re-election bid, to kind of put that into perspective.
So all we got was a campaign statement. We don't know how much she spent during the period, how much cash she had on hand. This is meant to be a show of force. Like, hey, I'm not messing around. I raised $3.2 million. I'm going to raise a lot more going forward. She has no opponent right now. In talking to Republicans, they've told me, yeah, that's a good number, you know. And the issue is going to be for these possible contenders, right? So I have to note too, FEC reports are due July 15th. So I'll spend my next weekend looking at the FEC website, pulling numbers. But Tom Tiffany, congressman from up north, he's talked about running. What's he going to put out there? All right, he's been talking about it, traveling the state. If he doesn't up his number quite a bit, it's hard to say you're serious about running for U.S. Senate, right? Scott Mayer, Franklin businessman, Eric Hovde, a Madison businessman, they've talked about running. Their challenge is they can write big checks. We know that. How big is remains to be seen, but how big a check can they write? Then do they face a Tim Michaels problem? So Tim Michaels put $20 million of his own money in the campaign for governor last year. He infamously said, I'm going to self-fund basically the primary. I'm not asking for money, right? The challenge was, once he did that, if you're a donor who would normally give $500, why do you get $500 if the guy's going to say, I'm going to write a check for $20 million or $30 million? You go, well, you've got that much money. Why should I give you some of my hard-earned money when I don't make that kind of cash? So for Mayer and Hovde, the question is going to be, do you have a problem raising money? Because I don't know how the checkbooks are, but let's say rate of inflation. She raised almost $31 million for the cycle last time, 50, not the question, 60. I mean, I'm not just throwing numbers out there because we don't know. Also, that'll be driven by how important is Wisconsin. Right now, if I'm a Republican, I'm going, okay, I'm going West Virginia, I'm going to Ohio, I'm going to Montana. My question is, where do I go next? Pennsylvania, Nevada, Wisconsin, Arizona? Lots of questions, but Wisconsin's not top of the list right now. So that might keep down how much they raise overall. Again, back to that check. Hovde and Mayer, how big has it got to be, and can you keep writing them to match what she is going to raise if she keeps this pace up? I mean, just do some basic math, you know, $3 million this quarter is going to go up next quarter, up again. I mean, they always build toward a crescendo on these campaigns. So she's got some healthy fundraising coming in, and not just her numbers are important looking ahead. We're going to see state numbers in about a week and a half. And, you know, Governor Evers made that joke about three-term Tony at the state convention.
Right.
I'll be interested to see if he has a big numbers fundraising report. My guess is he's not going to. My guess is that they're not putting the emphasis on raising money like he did. But look, even after his first election, they began right away building toward 2022. My guess is there's going to be less effort toward 2026 for some obvious reasons. We're also going to see, you know, what state candidates did and get a final number on the state Supreme Court race in Wisconsin, and just how much was spent Ooh. In that bad boy this spring.
There'll be some interesting numbers. Staying on the topic of 2024, also want to mention some news that we got this morning. Ron DeSantis, a Republican presidential candidate, did commit to going to Milwaukee this August to participate in the Republican presidential debate. Now, there's still this big lingering question. Will former President Donald Trump show up to it? But also, DeSantis is going to make another stop here in Wisconsin, Jared, that you reported on.
Yeah, so on Tuesday, he's got a fundraiser. He planned one stop originally, sold it out, added a second one, be Lake Geneva and Heartland for two fundraisers. Worth noting that Dick and Liz Uline, the Illinois business couple and mega donors, Republicans, are listed as hosts on both of the invitations. There's some other like kind of big Wisconsin names there. John Gard, former Assembly Speaker, his wife Kate Zuski, former Revenue Secretary, Ave B, former PSC Chair, a lot of kind of Republican names who are big, Steve Einhorn, big donor, traditional donors are there, which raises the question, is the Republican donor class in Wisconsin going to get behind the DeSantis campaign, and does that counteract the kind of grassroots thing for Trump? Marquette poll again, it showed that DeSantis has a pretty decent number here in Wisconsin. Charles Franklin, the director of that poll, did a deep dive into his numbers this past week because the questions were raised. We are an outlier. Every other state you look at, you're seeing polls where Trump is pulling away mm-hmm. from DeSantis. Well, in Wisconsin, they're neck and neck in a 10-candidate field, in a two-person field. DeSantis is up by 16 points. So Franklin went, look, is that because the independent-leaning Republicans are, like, affecting it? He found no. The base Republicans, independents, are basically about the same. It's more that, you know, people are not enamored with Trump as much as they used to be in the GOP, at least what he surveyed. And so he said his numbers look good to him, essentially.
All right. And we'll see if those numbers change as more polls come out. All right. That will do it for this week's show. Thanks so much for joining us. I'm Emily Fannin.
And I'm J.R. Ross.
Have a great weekend. We'll see you next week.
This program was brought to you from Wisconsin Eye's Margaret Farrow Studio.
Rewind. Your Week in Review is sponsored by the Wisconsin Realtors Association, bringing Wisconsin communities to life with great homes, businesses, and neighborhoods. The Wisconsin Realtors Association, the voice of real estate.